I'm not really talking about Bonobo, Gnogram component and document the model. Bonobo is a very cool thing, but I have to tell you about the origin of, oh my god, this is very loud. Bonobo was, the Bonobo name actually comes from, that's my machine suspending. Yeah, there we go. No, we don't. No, it's my machine just decides to suspend if it thinks I'm not around. So Bonobo is two things. One of them is it's a cute little animal they discovered in Africa a few years ago. It's a chimpanzee. It's what many people call it pygmean chimpanzee. And the feature of this pygmean chimpanzee is that it's genetically the one who is more like a human from the genetic point of view. It also happens to have sex 6 times a day. And this basically killed all the corporate image we had for the component model. And on the other hand, it's a bonobo, so this little chip. And that's me. So what are we wanting to do? You have to know a little bit about the story of the GNOME project. The GNOME project was originally designed to be, the story begins one day in the summer of 1997, when I went to Microsoft to do an interview at the Internet Explorer team. So I was there interviewing, and one of the guys there explained me how the whole Internet Explorer thing worked, right? I was trying to impress him with my two opcodes of Spark assembly I knew, and the guy actually impressed me with his knowledge on a thing called ActiveX. And I thought ActiveX was just a system for the loading on secure code from the net and running it in your machine and having virus on demand. But it happens to not be the case. What ActiveX is a very cool system for doing component programming. Basically, it enables people to work on very small programs and tie them together. So for many years, all of us Unix people have been saying, don't pay attention. No, we didn't say that. Where's the organizer? No, where's... Yeah, basically I need a plug, otherwise it's going to be doing this all day. Hello, Phil. So, anyways, in the Unix community we have all these people saying we love Unix because you can write these small tools on like Microsoft, which is this bloated big thing, and actually there's nothing so far from the truth. It's actually the opposite way. When you double-click on your Internet Explorer icon and you launch that thing, you actually get about 70 small components launched all together, all talking to each other, all working together. Toolbars are components, input lines are components, history stuff is components, HTML renderers is a component, Java engine is a component, JavaScript is another engine, Visual Basic for the Internet is another component, their history, their XML parsers. All that stuff is independent components. Each one is a different little thing. And they just tie them together. So the actual source code for Internet Explorer is a little program of about 40 lines of code. That's the main application. It just loads components from other places. And on the other hand, on the Unix universe, I don't know if you have seen StarOffice, for example, or any of the big suites for Unix. What you have is this huge executable linked with this huge amount of libraries, and it's basically a big program. So we don't have a component model in Unix. A component model that will allow us to write applications in the way Microsoft is doing, which is writing small components and get them these little components talking to each other and giving you the impression that you have this big application. So to begin with, that is just to entertain you. So it's really not that important if it fails. Although my machine might crash. Actually, it's crashed. Oh, no, there it is. So the problem is that you have these big pieces of software and you want to reduce complexity. So people have been saying for ages that you have to use modularity, which is a way of encapsulating your data, and people have come up with this object-oriented stuff in which you have to create your object and you don't expose everything and you provide a very clean API, that sort of thing. The problem with object-oriented programming so far is that it's limited to the language in which you develop the object, right? If you develop an object in Java, it's a Java object. If you want to use it in C++, basically, what you have to do is just, you basically need a plug that won't screw my thingy. It's in there! Oh my god!
I was trying to see if I could figure that out for you.
Wait. No? Yeah, probably it needs some wiggling. Anyways, so I have the impression that that thing is not working. But anyway, so the point is that we want to have this infrastructure for building applications based on little components. And object-oriented languages just don't cut it. It's nice to have these abstractions, but these abstractions are limited to a language and to one address space. See, the big problem here is one address space. They're not designed to be reused in between multiple applications. So when Microsoft actually goes to court and they say, we cannot remove Internet Explorer completely from the operating system because it's going to break applications, they're actually saying the truth. Visual Studio actually depends on a bunch of these components that they have written because they are just reusing code, which is what we should be doing, but we don't have anything like that. So Unix has been basically lagging for a very long time in a number of areas just because we had these vendor fights. And not much progress has been done in that regard. So we already say that we have a component model in Unix, which is the command line, the pipes, right? You type in a command, and you put a pipe, and you put another command, and you put a pipe, and something else. The problem here is that the communication goes only from left to right, okay? And the second problem is that the information you're transferring basically doesn't contain any typed information. There's no way to know what information are you passing from one side to the other. You have to assume the content of the information based on the layout. If you know the difference between HTML and XML, everybody knows that? Yeah? No? Somebody doesn't know? Okay, somebody will explain to you. So, so basically the thing is that you want to have typed information, which HTML doesn't have. It just has formatting information. And XML, on the other hand, contains very good typed information. It tells you what the information actually means. So that's the problem with Unix pipes. You don't have information on what the information means. There's no type information. There's no way to do smart things with that. And if somebody does something stupid on the output, like, for example, if some of you have tried to parse the output of LPQ, you probably know that there's no way to parse that reliably. So we have a very crappy component system. It works for many tasks, but it's not the foundation for doing big applications. And the proof of that is that nobody has written an Office suite using the Unix component model, right? Nobody has used grep for doing a word processor. Anyways, so here's where you enter CORBA. So we had a number of goals in the GNOME project when we began the thing. Yeah. Many of the people who were involved originally in the GNOME project were also GIMP hackers. And GIMP had this feature of exposing the internals of the applications to a scripting language, which means that the scripting language could control the internals of the application and could do programmatic stuff with the application, right? Like doing an effect. So it would take the 15 necessary steps to create some special effect for you, and it's just a little program. So we wanted to expose the internals of applications to scripting languages to give people this power. And again, Microsoft beat us to do this because they have been doing this for a number of years now. They just haven't publicized it enough. These days they call it automation, which is the name they're using, or Visual Basic for applications. Anyways, so we wanted to do that, and we also wanted to have a communications layer for building this component architecture. And CORBA was the first thing that came to mind, and it was the best design. The specifications for CORBA are publicly available on the web, so you can just download the stuff, learn the stuff, and implement CORBA, which is what we did. It contains a very interesting thing. Part of CORBA is defining a clear interface between what services you provide and what services you can use, right? So it has a language called the interface definition language, which it's basically, think of it as a header file. It's equivalent of a header file, but it's language independent. It will work with any programming language around. And the other nice feature it has is that the specification for CORBA already contemplates the fact that you might want to add support for scripting languages and GUI designers, right? Like asking like dealing with new objects that you didn't know at compile time that existed, or new functions, or new features, right? So it's all taken care of in the CORBA specification. Now, a simple way of describing CORBA, for those of you afraid of the word, is that CORBA is just an object-oriented RPC. It's just a way of invoking a procedure running on another address space. So you have one program here, another program here, and it's basically a way of calling a function into separate programs. It can be in the same address space, though, so it's transparent. It can be in your address space, or it can be in a separate process, or it can even be on a different machine, right? So it's just a little RPC system, and it had this feature, so we chose that thing for building the component model. Now, CORBA has a number of limitations. The problem with CORBA is that the people who defined CORBA left half of the interesting features unimplemented or unspecified, and they said this is a vendor issue, let the vendor decide. So you ended up with lots of different ways of doing things with different vendors. So I'm going to talk to about what stuff we did with CORBA that we had to do on a vendor-specific way to get it working. So I was talking to you about interfaces, and think of an interface as a plug. Basically, you get a plug, and then you have to find something that you can stick in the plug, right? The plug is the one you put in the door. Oh, the socket. Oh, my God. So I got all the words are wrong here. So you have a socket, and then you have to plug something in, right? So that's the idea behind interfaces. You have a very well-defined interface, and if you have a SCSI port and you try to plug the laptop in, it's not going to work, right? You need a SCSI port on the other side. So that's the idea. That's the idea of the interfaces. And it's very important that you keep in mind interfaces because all the component stuff depends on the published interfaces, okay? So I have a nice graphic here. This is my artwork. It's the first time I actually do a drawing in Unix, and that's what came out. So, for example, we have a spreadsheet component. This actually is pretty close to the actual numeric interfaces. So we have three different interface blocks, well, sockets or whatever, which you can talk to and you can hook up to, and you can talk to these guys. So you can tell to the thing, I want you to print these pages, and you can tell to the thing, I want you to create a graphics. This is actually non-existent, so it's just an example there. And you can do other interesting stuff. But basically, you have different interfaces for doing different tasks. And for example, the print interface could have a print setup methods for describing in which size you want to print, the scaling, the margins, and then you have also a method for saying, well, I want you to print everything, or I want you to print some sheets, or just the selection. So you have an interface and a number of methods you can invoke inside the interface, right? So far, so good? Everybody understood? Okay, good. So another thing we wanted to do, I mean, once we were in this, once we got all excited about CORBA and the interface business, is that Unix sucks big time in terms of providing providing clearly defined interfaces for services. So, for example, when you send mail, the current API, the API we have in Linux in Unix is pipe, fork, exec, and hope it works. And the reason you have to say hope it works is because if you do any sort of magic, like keeping open sockets, keeping the sockets open in the wrong places, like closing standard error and then opening the socket again, and then you get the X connection there, and you send a message on the forked process, then you kill the thing. So you have to restore all the file descriptors to the original position, their original meaning. You have to reset any signal handlers to the values they had, and you have to reset the signal masks. And you have to take care of many little details, right, to get it right. It's probably okay for very simplistic applications, but once the application grows and it changes many more things of the environment of a process, you're going to get run into problems. So basically, there's no clean API for anything in Unix. There's no clean API. Well, there's some clean APIs, but those are very limited. So basically, there's no clean API for sending mail. You basically fork the thing, and you send some ASCII text, and you hope that the thing is going to be a well-formed message and that the thing will be able to be forwarded. So that sort of thing. There's no way to control the mail queue, for example. You cannot. There's no way a program can say, well, I want you to flush every mail that comes from this address. You basically depend on specific knowledge on send mail, for example, to flush the queue. But if you switch to queue mail, you have a new procedure. And if you switch to something else, you have a new procedure. So what we want to have is all these applications should expose the same interface. It doesn't matter which implementation of the system you use, they should be providing the same interface, the same little plug you talk to. So And there's lots of other stuff you want to control that way. So we wanted to do that, and as part of that, we implemented our own version of Corba, our own Corba, from zero. Nothing, we had nothing, and then now we have a Corba. See the difference? So we wrote this stuff. Actually, we is too much people. That's how we say in Mexico. It was implemented by Elliot Lee, Mosley, and Dick Porter. So one is at Red Hat and CUC, and Dick is in Trimroot, Trim something, whatever. He's with Alan. Anyways. So it was designed to be very small so that people wouldn't be scared of adding Corba to their applications. Unfortunately, Corba has always been bound to be a bloated pig, and that's mostly because of its C++ heritage. Corba implementations that use C++ tend to be bloated just because, I don't know what the programmers do. But anyways, so it has this bad reputation. So we wrote a Corba implementation which was designed to be thin. And the idea here is thin, very small, so that you can put it in every single command. Like the window manager, you want to put it on your terminals, you want to put it on every single command on the system. It's a different matter if they will actually accept the patches, but different problem. Anyways. So the first day, the nice feature of this is that the first day that Elliot Lee actually tested the speed of Orbit against the first class Corba implementation, the best one, which happened to be OmniORBit2, the one who held the world record for speed, Orbit was twice as fast. That was the first time. I mean, no profiling, no optimization, just the first attempt, it was faster by 100%. So that day he learned about using this tool called GProf, in which you profile your application. And he did some profiling and made Orbit be three times as fast as the fastest, compared to the fastest record holder. Did you get it right? Yeah, okay. So it kicks ass, basically. It's very small, and you can use it all over the place. So that's our infrastructure. So I mentioned a couple of minutes ago that Corba specification leaves a lot to be said, and vendors have to say that stuff. So what we added to the default Orbit, well, we added support for this, and you know, just enable activate it. Is we added authentication, which means that every single connection you do to Corba is authenticated. If you don't pass the authentication, that your request is dropped on the floor. It's to us, it's more important to be secure than to be compatible with other Corba implementations. We don't want people to break into your computer, so that's priority number one. It also integrates with our main loops, which means that Corba integrates with the whole event dispatching system of GTK, which is the toolkit we use in GNOME. And we added service activation. So you basically say, I need you to launch this object. So tell me when the object is ready and give me a handle to it. So we added that. And we're approaching an interesting thing. So basically, we have a thing called GoDIDs, which means GNOME Object Activation Directory. Actually, we were going to call it GNOME Object Network Activation Directory, but somebody complained that it was not politically correct. So the idea here is that's the way you reference a component, right? So GNUmeric will get a number assigned, like GNUmeric Workbook Factory version 1.0. So you have to use that handle, and you say, I need to talk to this object. And the system takes care of activating the server and returning to you a handle or telling you the user doesn't have the program, right? So this is an important concept. Keep it in mind. GoIDs are a unique identifier for a service, okay? You get it? Okay. So we have three types of we have three types of objects defined in the GNOME framework. We have objects implemented as executables, which means that an object to get a handle on the object, you have to launch a program, right? So, for example, we have the GNUmeric Workbook Factory, which is the thing that produces workbooks or spreadsheets, and this is implemented in the binary called /user/bin/GNUmeric, okay? Then we have library servers, which are the servers that get loaded into your address space. It's just basically a shared library, but your application doesn't know if it's a shared library or a remote application. So this is done for performance reasons. So if you have stuff that it's very timing dependent, you can write your server as a shared library. If the server crashes, it crashes your applications. That's the only side effect. So those are the two types of executables. And one interesting thing which is layered on top of these two, and it's sort of intermingled, is factory objects. So in the case of GNUmeric, the object GNUmeric is of type factory. It's not of type executable or library. which means it has to look up the factory for this object. And it first launches the object, and then it gets your handle to an instantiate, to a new instance of the object. So basically, user being numeric happens to be a factory object for the numeric workbook and a number of other things. And when you, if you create a workbook, it's going to launch the factory first and then ask the factory to get your handle. And all of this is done in a very nice way. So this is a sample file, just to give you an impression of how it works. The thing you see on the top, between brackets, that's a GOAT ID. It's the unique identifier for the service. The types, it can be either Excel, library, or factory, which identifies how you launch the thingy. The repo ID is a list of interfaces the object supports, which are the blocks. So it's a way of quickly discovering, without loading the object, if it will support a specific block. So you can request objects like, I need something that can handle PNG images, and I need the thing to be able to edit the images. So you send that query, and it gets you an object. That's if you don't know what the GOAT ID is for. And this basically lets the user customize whether they want to use the GIMP or XPaint for editing images. I mean, you have to be really stupid to use XPaint, but I mean, but some people do. And finally, location info says how do you activate the service in the case above. Yeah. So you have to use a. What was I saying? Oh, yeah, you have to launch the binary. And in this other case, the location info, given that it's a factory, identifies the GOAT ID for the factory. See? Very obvious, very obvious. It's turning off itself. So, oh, my God. We already talked about this, right? Oh, no. So, to activate a service, you use the GOAT ID. We have two types of activation. On the X server, which means that services are bound to the display. And this is important. It's important to make this difference because the applications are only run for only run on a single X server. So all of that. You cannot have a single workbook that can work across many displays or many users. You have to, you need to activate a workbook for each. Okay. And the other one is the user-based one, which is just for stuff like you stick your pilot in. In behalf of the... I'm doing something wrong. In behalf of the user. So basically, you just say, I need to talk to the contact manager for this user, which is where you store your information like name, telephone, address, that sort of thing. And it gets launched, and it can be shared across all of the servers of if you have a pilot or not, like my new pilot I bought for $200. So now, Microsoft design, Microsoft, I feel like a singer.
Like doing karaoke?
I feel karaoke. And this didn't work either. Oh, yes, it does. Okay, so those were the problems we were facing, and we had to implement a solution for that. So the solution was basically to look up, well, you have to keep in mind that the Denon project is not a research project. We cannot afford research because research basically means that somebody's paying you for spending 12 months a year for doing nothing, coming up with a result that says it proves to be useful or it proves to not be useful. So what we do is basically we steal all the it proves to be useful idea that some other researcher did, and we don't take the ones that didn't prove to be good, right? So for example, you don't copy the Amiga user interface, you copy the Mac one. Well, you get the idea. It was just an example. So, I don't care. They failed. And it was an example. It was an interface, an example. So basically, we have... Oh yeah, this is a roadmap so that you don't get bored during the next 45 minutes because it's gonna be dense. I mean, it included some pictures, but this is a good roadmap. So basically we have interfaces that define the interactions between, well, that define the interaction required to create compound documents, right? That means you have a container and you have containees, right? You have a thing and you have thingies that you put inside. So that's the first thing. Then we have object naming and object transferring, and that's another set of interfaces that just deal with naming an object and transferring this object around. Then we have a third problem, which is object storage, and it's how do you store, once you have this container and these containees, how do you store this information on the disk, right? How do you get this to be saved in a place? Then we have interfaces for dealing with the actual visualization of the things on the screen, right? Like how do you get the interactions right so that the thing actually appears on a window? It doesn't work.
There's no on button.
Okay. Oh, you're recording. Okay, I see. So, so basically, if you have a spreadsheet and you have a chart component that you click on the component, the spreadsheet should include now a toolbar that says that, that contains stuff for it, for making changes to your charts. That's the idea. So if you have used Microsoft something, you basically have seen this in action. And then finally, there's the control interfaces, which are designed to basically mimic the ActiveX, how do they call them, controls, and the Java Beans. See, the problem with Java Beans is that Java Beans is a framework for doing components and controls within Java. You cannot use a Java Bean in your C++ application or in C or in Unix without Java. There's no way you can do it, no way to interface them. So that's a problem of object-oriented systems that only work within a system. That's why we have to go to the next step, which is Cora, which lets you use these components in every single language in the system. So now, the thing you have to keep in mind is that we have all these interfaces, which are these blocks, these contracts between the components. And the GNOME system has an implementation of these interfaces, right? This means that you're free to not use our implementation. We think our implementation is pretty good. But if you don't like it, you can implement the same interfaces using whatever thing you want, right? So, that being said, I'm going to talk about the wonderful GNOME implementation.
So, it's extremely simple to create components and create applications that use these components.
So, what did we do? Oh, yeah, the first step is stealing somebody else's idea. And in this case, we stole Microsoft ideas for the interactions, the interfaces between containees and containers. And the reason is that the Microsoft interfaces are very simple. And people think that OLED2 is very complex, and it's very complex because Microsoft actually did a very bad mistake at implementing it. They just had too much historical baggage they had to deal with. So since we didn't have that problem, we came up with a very key implementation, a very easy implementation to use. So our implementation is based on the GDK object system. Basically, all of the GDK objects provide default behaviors for all of the core bus servers. All of these, every interface is implemented by a server. So basically, we wrapped every core bus server around the GDK object. And the way you extend things is either you subclass the GDK object just by using the traditional subclassing features of your favorite language, or you can hook up to the event emission. And they'll send it feature of GDK objects. GDK objects keep telling the world what is happening inside them. So you can hook up to these special signals and see what is going on in the object. So what this means is that you don't have to create a new, you don't have to subclass if you don't want to. You just can hook up to the interesting events and you don't have to make any changes. This is basically the shift between the AWT in Java and the new listener stuff and the new Java GUI thing. And it's also used in something else, but I forget. Anyways, so we kicked ass, basically, which means that you can create a container application. This is an application that can use existing components in 5 lines of code. And it's up to you if you want to check the error return values. You should do that, but many people don't. That's the principal source of security holes in Unix.
of people just doing system calls without checking return values. So you should do the five lines of extra checking. And the minimal object server, and this is an embeddable object that you can stick inside an application, has 65 lines of code as of this morning. So it might grow if we add more features. But that's the minimal you can do. And this is an embeddable object that can reuse all of what you know. I haven't talked too much about Bonobos. Here's where the interesting stuff comes in. The basic idea here is that you want to be able to load arbitrary objects, and you want to be able to deal with new stuff that was not designed to be dealt with to begin with. Now that sounded terrible. You want to be able to load new objects and work with new objects even if the application was not designed to deal with them at the beginning. So the very foundation of the GNOME component system, and those of you that know Ole probably recognize this stuff, is the basic interface, which is called the unknown interface. And it's the base object for every single other class in Bonobo, the persistent object, the monitors, the containers, the views, the UI handlers, all of that stuff, everything derives from this very interface. And it has three methods. The first two, ref and unref, are just methods for doing memory management. Basically, when you get a handle on an object and you plan on keeping a handle to it, you have to ref it, which means basically, do not die on me. And when you're done using the object, you unref it, so you can have multiple users of the same object, and you ensure proper destruction of the object. That's a fairly common practice between programming, and actually the entire GTK system and the entire GNOME libraries use a ref-unref system. And then you have this little guy here, which is called query interface. And you basically invoke this method passing a repository ID. This is a Corba interface. So you request the object and you ask the object, do you support the interface .bark? And if it says yes, then you can invoke methods of the .bark object. You can also query the object and you say, do you know how to save yourself in a file? And the object can answer, no, I don't know how to save myself in a file. So you can probably work out something else with the object. So this is basically a way of negotiating with the object what features it provides and which features you can make use of. So the basic idea here is that once you call query interface, every single object that deals with these sort of things, every single piece of code that deals with these sort of things, has to be able to degrade itself. It has to be able to just say, well, if this feature is not available, I'm not going to use it, right? But it should work every single time. It just has to go into degraded mode. So far, so good? Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's a little guy. Remember the nice picture I showed you at the beginning? So this is an object that exposes the GNOME unknown interface, which I have drawn there like with a little circle, which is pretty nice. Those are the methods exported by the object. So you can talk to that little circle there and ask the circle to perform any of these three functions. Right? Oh. I'm drawing? Oh my God. Awful. Okay. So when you call query interface, you basically make an invocation on a little circle, then you ask for a new object, and it returns you a new block to which you can connect to. So that's the basic way you invoke it. You say object query interface, and then you say, guy, can you be embedded? Yes or no, and then you get that handle on EI, and that's how you talk to that guy. Okay. The way you use stuff in the GNOME system is that you create the GNOME implementation of Bonobo. And keep in mind, this is the GNOME implementation. You're free to implement this in whatever other way you want. If you want to use the Microsoft way of doing things, you are free to do so. We just happen to do a better job than they did. Actually, the Microsoft Foundation classes do something very similar to this. So what you do is you create one object, you create a second object. You basically have to do some configuration to get the objects to talk to each other, like whenever you get activated, tell this other guy to activate the menus, and when you get the menus, tell this guy to hide itself, that sort of thing. So, but the basic idea is that you create the two objects, you configure the objects, and then you say objects merge. So basically, you merge the two objects, and they become one, right? And that's how you can query one interface. So if you ask the guy, so if you ask A, do you support the interfaces of B, it's going to return, yeah, I support B, and this is B. And if you ask B, do you support A, it's going to say, yes, I support A, and it returns A. And if you ask something else, it's going to say, no, I don't support that. So that's the way you aggregate objects. And that's the simplest way. There's many other ways of aggregating, but that's the simpler one. But that's the basic idea, the basic construction thing. Now, we're going to go into how do you actually save the stuff. So once you have your compound document, you want to store it in a file. And the best abstraction, the abstraction that everybody has used, OpenDoc, actually OpenDoc and all that too, and I don't know of any other examples, is basically that you implement a CORBA interface that represents a file system. So when you actually save a Word file, what you're saving is a little file system that contains your document, and if you embedded an Excel chart, it contains a subdirectory inside that has the Excel information. So from the point of view of the application, every application has a whole directory to dump their stuff in. So you, in a file, you stick the summary information, in another one, you stick the contents, that sort of thing. And this is implemented by two interfaces. One of them is called the GNOME Storage, which provides a directory-like API. The GNOME Streams represents a file system API. There's a bunch of backends for these two interfaces, see? You can have multiple implementation of these interfaces. You're getting it, right? Everybody's getting it. Like a SCSI port, you have a disk drive, implements the SCSI interface, but it's a disk drive. Then you put a tape drive, which implements the SCSI interface, but it's a tape drive. It's a different thing. And you can put a scanner. So there are different objects talking the same interface. So this is the same here. We have a thing called libEFS, which is basically a file system inside a file implementation. We have libOLED2, which is only used by Gnumeric right now. And it provides you with access to Microsoft OLED2 file format, which is exactly this. This is copied from there. And a native file system for debugging purposes. So you can say, I want to create a store in this directory. And basically, it lets you poke through the file system and see what actually went. So you don't need a debugger. You just set a flag, and then you can see what's actually going on in case you have problems. You can also have a memory-based implementation. So it doesn't have to be an actual file system thing. It can be as if you implement the interface, it's up to you what you're doing on the other side. And we also have the progressive interfaces that are actually a variant of these ones, which provide a callback mechanism so that you can do progressive loading from the network. So this is the foundation on which you store the files for compound documents. Now, given this, each component that can be restored from a file or loaded or, yeah, restored from a file or served its state to a file has to implement two new interfaces, the persist storage, persist stream, and persist file. Persist storage basically means can you store yourself in a directory-like structure, and here is the API to store yourself. Persist stream, which says can you store yourself in a plain file, and if so, do it in this place. And the persist file, which instead of talking to an abstract stream, is talking about absolute path names in a single computer. So that doesn't work over the network, so you don't want to use this one. It's just an optimization for a case, which Nat is going to complain in a second, but I have a good answer this time. So. Oh my God, I actually prepared my defense for that one. Wow. Well, actually, well, it shouldn't, but we can. Anyway, so money cares. Nat is gonna be making fun of me, but I don't care. He knows why. Anyways, so the way you name objects in Bonobo, it's the same way you name objects in OLED 2. And you basically have a moniker, which is a handle to an existing object, right? So instead of it's a handle that can restore the object from any source. This is the way you implement linking. When you drag, I'm going to get to that. When you drag an object from the spreadsheet and you just drop it on the word processor, you actually get a handle that says how to restore this stuff from the other thing. So we have three monikers, and this is how it works. We have a moniker that can restore the state from a file. So given a file, it can restore the object, right? So far, so good. So for example, sales.gnumeric, you have a moniker that says how to restore sales into something that you can display, right? So you just say, activate this object, this is the path, get it. Then you have an item moniker, which is basically a per object thing for it's up to the implementation of the object to deal with this thing. And finally, a thing to compose them. And here is an example. This is a Lispish example of it. That's because I like Lisp. So if you don't like Lisp, you're stuck with example. But it's very simple to translate it to other things. Basically, you have a function called compose moniker, which is going to compose a bunch of monikers. And it's going to invoke the first moniker, which is called file moniker, on the object numeric workbook and the file sales.numeric. So you're saying, this object with this file. Now get me the object. Once you get the object, you apply the moniker, get me the object called sheet 1. So now you get, you narrow it to the sheet 1. And then you apply a moniker called D4F10. So that gets you a cell region. And that's the handle you get. That's the handle that actually gets transferred to the other thing. So the other guy only knows about the result of the compose moniker, the result of this function. It doesn't know what's going on inside. So that's how you drag information. That's how you select the region. You do edit copy and edit paste special. So that's how it works. The interesting thing here is that monikers implement get on persist file, which means a moniker knows how to store its state in a file. That's where all the linking comes from. When you store this stuff in a file, you basically can restore it just by loading it, and then you have the component loaded. The other two features is that a moniker can be created from a string representation. So if you have a special string that has little commands like list stuff, it's not list, but imagine that stuff, it can recreate the object from that string description. And given an existing moniker like the one you actually transferred, copy-pasted, you can get a textual representation that you can write down in your compiler and then restore it from another place. See? Or in a sheet of paper. It doesn't matter. So that's a cool stuff. So now we have the compound document interfaces. I'm going to go real fast because this is very boring and you don't want to know the details. But we have on one side the containers. And containers contain objects. And a container itself can be another object containing something else, right? So you can have things layered. So we have three concepts. We have the container, which represents an entire document. Then for each object you insert, you have to create a client side, which is basically your proxy to talk to the object. The object talks to the client side, and the client side talks to the container. It's for very very specific tasks. And then each client side can have multiple views. For example, if you have imagine an Emacs window, or imagine numeric, a spreadsheet. So many people, there's a very common operation in spreadsheet editing, which means that you, which consists of dragging a little line, and it splits the view. So you have two views, and they are synchronized. So you can do editing of the, you can see the month here, and then you can be filling stuff 2 kilometers away from there. So what happens if you have an object embedded, like an image? You need to be able, when you split, to show the image in both places. So each component should be ready to provide multiple views of the same information. So when I demand you, get me a new view of the stuff, you have to provide me exactly a new copy of the same stuff rendered. It's very simple to implement. It's very simple. Don't get afraid. I just saw a couple of faces that were like... But it's very simple to implement, and there's sample code to show you how. And containees on the other object can have to implement these two interfaces. Embeddable objects, which is an object that can be embedded in a document, and a view. And of course, you can have a mix between those. Or the guys that can be sandwiched between containers and containers. So those are the interfaces, and here is some more Miguel artwork. So we have a container there. It has an interface. It has unknown, so it knows how to talk to each other. And the user goes and selects, I want to insert some component. So you get something like this. You load the spreadsheet component, and then you create a client side, which is the thing inside a container. And then you hook these guys up. You hook these guys up, and basically you keep... on this guy, you have a reference to the client side, and the container, you have a reference to this guy. And you have to do this process for every one of the little nested things that go in. Just copy the code. I swear to God, it's 10 lines of code you have to copy. The view frames, which is something I didn't show you there. I'm going to show you in the next beautiful drawing. Basically, it's the endpoint from the server point of view for doing any GUI work. Like, I need you to merge these menus. Here are the menus. And you send the menus, and the other guy catches the menus and does something with it. It's actually done by a special interface called the UI handler interface. But you get to this guy through that guy. These are the visual interfaces on the container, the one on top and the one on the bottom. And the one sandwich is the one that you have to implement on the container. As I told you, the sample code is there, and you can see how it works. So basically, we have the GNOME embeddable, and a GNOME embeddable has to provide multiple implementations of GNOME View. Now, this component was supposed to be a little man component because I had this drawing of a little man on the chart program, but it was crashing when I was editing the little man. So I changed that to that thing, which is supposed to be a router. So that's the idea. So as you can see, you can have the same object can be rendered in a split window here with different zoom factors. That's something you have to keep in mind. The views can be affected by the zoom factor, and it can be also displayed in a completely irrelevant window, right? So that's how you do that stuff. I know you didn't care. That exchange, as I said a couple of minutes ago, for cut and paste and drag and drop is done by transferring the moniker name. Then we have Bonobo Components, which is basically another interface you have to query for. You said, are you a component? And then are you a control? And then the control says, yes, I'm a control. And then you can talk to this control. Basically, these interfaces have to provide, this is not even implemented, but this is the plan. And it works in Microsoft, and we're just going to steal the design. Basically, you ask the thing, can you configure yourself visually? And they says, yes. So it pops up a little window when the user goes to a GUI designer and says, I want to edit you. So it pops up the window. You do all the customization there. And you click on Save Properties. So you need another interface for that, which is save and load your state from a dictionary. And the dictionary is basically the little browser you see with Visual Basic and all those tools like Delphi, where you have a property, the name, and the possible values. So you have to be able to support that interface. And one of the main goals is to integrate it with Glade, which is our GUI designer in the GNOME project. And I'm going to show you Glade just because I like Glade, not because it's even related to Bonobo. GNUmeric is the first application that implements lots of these interfaces. We have an image viewer for PNG files, a text viewer, and an audio player. So you can embed an audio player in your Word document and see the thing playing the piano. It's very useless. We have the GIMP. Elliot Lee has already modified the GIMP to be a component, so you can embed GIMP objects inside your application. So you get a pre-rendered version of the object by default, and when you double-click, it activates GIMP, and then you do all that stuff. It renders and doesn't activate, blah, blah, blah. It's not yet implemented, but we found an API call that does that. Anyways, AB Word is being bonobized as we speak. Elliot Lee started a week ago, and he's sending patches to AB Word people, and they're just overwhelmed with the quality of the patches. Okay. Well, I have to say something about AB Word. It's a very nice program, but I think they have made a fundamental mistake. They're using the Netscape hierarchy for organizing source code, so it's impossible to understand that source code. And my friend Nat Friedman here, who has dealt with Netscape and AB source code more than anybody else I know, well, probably Mike Shaver, but he likes suffering. He can't understand the thing. You spend hours just browsing the file system, finding the function. It's just hidden between a hierarchy of 500 records. It's a very painful thing. And this also doesn't belong to Bonobo at all, but I think it's cool. And you're stuck with the demo. And it's the thing that in GNOME we have two document models. We have a document model, which is for compound documents, which I talked about it in the talk. That's Bonobo. And we have another one. How much time I have left? Oh, my God. Okay. And we have this one, which is the web consortium stuff. Is basically what you have used as dynamic HTML. Our implementation of the thing, it's called GDOM, and it's basically the GNOME DOM plus ref and ref, because they again fucked up because they thought that the world was Java, and it's not. We have a sample application that does that. It's GNOME Illustrator. It's a very nice program because it was written in a week. And it basically loads SVG files, which is a new standard from Adobe for structured vector graphics. That's what SVG means. What? Scalable vector. It's not structured? Yeah. So all these people are fighting to get a working version of their stuff, and we already have a working version. And it was done in 1 week. And it was done in 1 week because we kick ass in one side. And because GNOME, and this is something I wanted to talk more about GNOME instead of this stuff, but I said I was going to do a Bonobo talk, so I'm stuck doing this. But the nice thing about GNOME is that we have this huge foundation of tools and libraries and development crap these days, that coming up with an application like this was pick XML, pick DOM, pick the canvas, pick libart, pick GNOME config, pick something else, you have an application. So it's nice. So I'm going to show you that because it doesn't belong to this talk, but I'm going to do it. You can pull bonobo from that place. You can help. Oh, the bonobos are in an endangered species. They were discovered 40 years ago, and and people are killing them. So you can help them if you go to that webpage. And me and Nat are working on bonobo and getting a release out as soon as possible. I mean, in tar format. Right now, you have to use a CVS. So while you ask me questions, I'm going to load. Oh my God, I'm going to load stuff you don't care. So here is Gil. This is the SVG viewer. And this is a demonstration I like. The GNOME canvas, you have to know that the GNOME canvas is this beautiful engine that does anti-aliasing display. Anti-aliasing, you know, doing very nice graphics that look very sharp, very professional. And it does transparency, which means that these objects are not actually opaque. If you see, you can see through the one and see a piece of the other one. You see? Like, let me show you. You see? Wow. And that's basically the canvas implements the PostScript imaging model. It's not actually like that, but you think you have the PostScript imaging model with two extensions, anti-aliasing and alpha composition. So this thing was implemented in a week, and it loads SVG files. And all these people at the SVG consortium are fighting to get their stuff working. So anyways, this is Gil, and it does anti-aliasing. That's nice. Actually, I should show you that because anti-aliasing is nice. So look at that thing. You see? It's not a hard black line. It's a line that has little shades of gray over the way down. So this is just an illusion to make you humans think that you have a better monitor than you actually have. So anyways, that's one thing. And the other one is, so guys, you have to ask me questions. What? An X term? We have GNOME terminal. Well, I don't know what you could. I mean, if you want to waste your time, it's yours. but we have a nice X term, which is there. That's the GNOME terminal. I can do lots of shit. I don't feel like demonstrating a terminal application. We have one. And it does transparency like e-term and all that shit. But the difference is that we do the color dithering correctly, and we do it fast, unlike other stuff. Anyway, so I'm going to show you the latest toy, which I think is the most cool thing since GNOME. And this is the GUI designer for GNOME. Basically, you these days, instead of hacking all your code manually, you sit down. You draw your stuff. So if you want to put an entry, you stick it there, and you have an entry. And you go here, and you can configure its properties, right? You can say where it goes, all that shit, right? You can attach actions, like in Visual Basic. So you say, whenever the text changes, for example, in change it signal, right, invoke this method. Yada, yada, change it, right? Now, the cool stuff about this is that the actual file format for this dialog box you're looking at, this is the dialog box used by the spreadsheet, the numeric spreadsheet. This is the print setup. So so this file is actually stored in a beautiful, beautiful XML file. So what this means, I know you think, oh, that's stupid. Well, it's not. Let me explain you why. The reason is that usually traditional GUI designers, what they do is they output C code, you compile the C code, then you make a little change because it was wrong, and then you figured out that you have to go back to the GUI designer because you wanted to add an extension, and then you add the extension, and then you lost the change. Right? That's the wrong way of doing things. So what we have is a library, a companion library to Glade that loads these interfaces. So basically, you never touch the GUI stuff. You just load the file, and then you connect your C code with this piece, right? So if you want to see the dialog box in action, That dialog box is this one. This is dialog box once it has connected. As you can see, this one contains bitmaps, which were generated after the, which are generated at runtime. And you have a little page here, a beautiful little page. Oh my God, I have less fingers anyway. Points. Headers and footers. If you want to customize your header, that sort of thing. Pick. Oh, nice graphics. I think it's sort of useless. But that's Glade, and that was Gil, and that's the thing which I think is the most exciting right now going on in GNOME. So the GUI designer you saw, it's going to be integrated with Bonobo controls at some point. So questions now. The room is yours. The microphone is yours. You can make it part of you. Questions? No questions? Oh, yeah. The ref and the what? Okay, distributed garbage. Okay. Garbage collection, yes. You can implement, the thing is that if you don't have ref on ref, there's no way in this planet you can ever even attempt to think about garbage collection, right? On the other hand, if you have ref on ref and your language supports garbage collection, you can use that to build a garbage collection system. Let me tell you the story. The GTK object system actually got support for... The GTK object system was actually redesigned to use ref on ref when the scheme people required to use GTK because they needed garbage collection. So you need from the underlying libraries to use ref on ref. So that's the foundation on which you have to build on top of. See? So you need that stuff, want it or not. So it's up to your language binding to use it correctly or leave the hassle to the programmer. See? Does that answer your question? Good! Excellent. Yes? I think you have to use a microphone to the people can record this stuff. Yeah. Can somebody forward this to this guy?
Yeah.
I was just wondering what happens if an object is refed but never unrefed? For instance, if your program comes along to refs an object,
and it dies and it never unrefs, so it has a bug. Okay, so if you never unref, then the object stays there.
Yeah, if you segment violate.
Yeah, it stays there. It's a bug. I mean, but... No, it's not a bug. Okay, let me explain. What you're trying to do here is what most researchers have called distributed garbage collection, and that's still a research topic. So we're not about doing research topics. We're trying to do the best effort. And the best effort in this case means being always correct by doing reference counting, which means the object won't go away under you. And the best job comes in the part when you unref stuff. So if you're missing some unrefs so bad, you have a process in memory that's going to be swapped. But it's a research topic, and it has to be discussed with the research people. We just do the best thing that can be done. Yeah? You wanted to say something? Well, for some definition of reasonable, well. Right? I mean, yeah, well, you can do timeouts and ping the thing. Actually, many implementation repositories require the objects to have a ping method. So you basically ping the method, and if the thing is... If it's not alive, they kill the method. I think that's broken, right? Because you can have a network short cache, and then you launch another object that you didn't need. So, or the process can be just swapped into disk, and the machine is trashing, and then you launch another. I mean, I don't think that's a good idea. I think the Java people screwed up in many areas. Anyway, but there are so many nice things about Java. Actually, Nan and I were at Cygnus last week, and we were talking about the integration of the base Java object class of the native Cygnus compiler with the base GTK object class. And it doesn't seem to be very difficult. We might actually be able to do it. Just keep the same object structures in the same format, which means that Java is going to be getting native GTK object support, and we're going to be able to write applications in Java with the thing that is Java to native code, not Java to stupid bytecode, which nobody wants to use, and it's very slow. So we're going to be having the power of the language, which is beautiful, and we're going to get the speed of the machine that we, I mean, we put some money into getting the Pentium 2, right? So why think you have a 486? Right? More questions? Yeah? Yeah? How does the image actually get transferred? Okay, it's X Windows rep renting. So, yeah, you transfer the X Window ID and then you do X Window rep rent. Yeah, the other approach is the Microsoft and the Microsoft broken approach, which means you have to implement things two times. You have to implement the server and then you have to implement a proxy server that draws in the address space of the application. So when you activate GNUmeric, you have to load GNUmeric and GNUmeric proxy into the application. And this guy tells this guy what to draw on the screen. Yeah. Yeah, the panel does that right now with applets, but the way we're doing it is the same with applets. I mean, we could have done the Microsoft way, but it's completely broken, completely stupid. It doesn't make any sense. Now, Federico here is thinking of a way of transferring Canvas items, which means that we could have fully anti-aliased, fully transparent objects being transferred, bonobo objects transferred from one process to the other. So if you want to know more about that, you can talk to Federico here, which is doing the magic behind that. It's pretty cool. I mean, it's all this stuff is pretty exciting, so I'm excited. I mean, it's just so kick-ass. It's so perfect. It's so beautiful. Doing all this infrastructure that was never done before for Unix and getting it to do it right and meeting all these cool people who know more than you is very cool. So, more questions? Yeah? What? Oh, okay, I got it. So the question is, how did I solve the big mess with the registering com? Well, we have independent files. Remember the GNORBA file I showed you? Right? Those are independent files. It's like etc. rcd init.d something. So it's just you just drop a file and that basically registers the service with the system. That's how it works. Then you have to use some SSH power to do the file copying. No, actually, you have to do more than SSH copy the files. You actually have to put a wrapper to activate the service on a remote machine. But you have to do that anyways if you want to do that stuff. So it's up to you to do the distribution for the machines. Remember, we're not using CORBA for its distributed nature. That's a nice side effect that we get. But we're not using it for that, and we're not going to be addressing those sort of problems. It's still the door is open for you to do it, but it's not. We're not dealing with that right now. We actually have to change the authentication system to use a public key system, crypto. So, but you have to talk to Nat because he has the design. So talk to him. More questions? What? Oh yeah. We discussed all of this with Ray. Actually, Ray, finally. Finished convincing me. I was very skeptical, but Nat and Rafe managed to convince me that it was the right thing to do. So basically, if you're in the US, you're gonna get this warning that says for all distributions shipped from the US, you're gonna get this warning that says when you try to use a network, basically we cannot guarantee that the information is safe. If you want to get your information safe, you have to download this package from Iceland, which is where the security patches are. And then you get crypto. If not, you are insecure. So that's what you're going to get in the future when we implement this stuff, right? More questions? Yeah? Yeah. What is KDE again? No. I don't know. Integration in what regard? They come up with their own component document model, which I personally think it's completely broken. And I think that because the base class in KDE has 37 methods, I think. So you have to implement 37 methods to begin with. You can use a lot of inheritance in C++, but this doesn't work for every language. So it's a hard task to reuse those interfaces in other setups. So the beauty of this approach, of the query interface approach, is that you start very small. And you start with a working system with no implementation, with no work. So we couldn't adopt the design of KDE. It was too broken to be adopted by GNOME.
because we don't depend on C++, and we want to be using Java, and we want to be using Scheme, and we want to be using Python, and we want to be using Perl, and binding this stuff, binding these 37 interfaces and all these ideas they have is not easy. So that's why we have two different object models. I think their system is based on the thesis of Torben, which basically he said, well, I have to do a thesis, I have to do this, so I'm going to come up with a system. So he came up with a system which is a thesis system. And this stuff is basically copied from what we know it works. So that's the difference. I don't know about any other integration issues between the component models so far. More questions? Yeah? Oh, for Bonobo? Well, we have been saying on Monday for about 2 months. Bonobo is probably going to be the first GNOME package that the first public release is going to contain documentation. Actually, Nat did lots of the work of getting the stuff done. So, and we're waiting right now on Nat on finishing the UI handler.
Monday.
So Monday it is. I guess.
Did they say which Monday?
That's fair, right? No, it's we're just finishing the UI handler. The thing is that we have this idea now that meme spreading. Basically, you have an idea, then you publish it, and then people start copying it, and then you have all this code that uses the same idea, and then if you change your mind, you have to change all these ideas that were already out. So we're trying to get at least the basic to be right, to Yeah, the documentation meme is important. So that means that the default components we're shipping with Bonobo come with documentation and a framework for documenting the components. Interfaces supported, how do you call them, what do you do if they support it, if they not, that sort of thing. Because we want every single component from now on to be documented. We basically learned a very bad lesson in the GNOME project, and it was that leaving the documentation for when we finish the project was a very bad idea. So we're not trying to fix that mistake. See? So any more questions? You're all happy? Good. So that was it.